Okay. My name is Frank Olkin. I'm here at the National Science Foundation, and this is the Ontolog teleconference entitled Towards a Quantities and Units of Measure Ontology-Based Standard. It's June 19th, 2009, and the time is 12:12 Eastern Daylight Time in the United States. I just have a few very brief remarks here. You should be able to see my slides. That was slide one. Slide two you've already heard. We'd like everybody except the speakers here to maintain radio silence, essentially. Keep your phone on mute or there'll be too much noise in the background. And our agenda on slide three, we're going to start with Stan Huff on experience and requirements for units of measure and patient data exchange, from the work he's been doing on that. Then David Price will speak on the OASIS Product Lifecycle Committee requirements for unit ontology. David McComb will then speak on the GIST unit of measure ontology. Then if Bob Dragoset manages to get on, he will talk about the units markup language that he's developing at NIST. Rob Raskin will talk about the, from NASA, will talk about the SWEET 2.0 scientific units ontology. Pat Cassidy will then talk about aligning the NASA SWEET Psi units ontology with COSMO. Howard Mason will talk, I believe it's from ISO, will be talking about units of measure, how many standards. And then Pat Hayes will speak on making distinctions. That should take us to something like 110, 115, assuming everyone sticks to 10 minutes. And we're going to ask folks to hold their questions till we get to the discussion. And we should have, depending on exactly when we finish, we expect the teleconference to run to 2:30, so we should have at least an hour for discussion, I'm hoping, if we all stay on time. And I will either by the chat room or, if necessary, intervening onto the telephone call teleconference, I will try to keep everyone on schedule here so that we can get through all the speakers. It's not really fair to the speakers at the end if people earlier speak much longer than 10 minutes. I did on slide four. One of the questions that we'll try to address today, and that a number of the speakers will speak to, is what will be the scope of a units of measure ontology? Clearly, we want to be able to include units of measure, but in addition to that, there are issues of, are we going to include a discussion of the dimensions? So units of measure are things like meters and feet. Dimensions are mass, length, time, I think luminous intensity, current, a couple others. And you can have these things to various exponents between plus and minus 3. So, for example, mass per divided by length cubed will get you density. Then we have to answer the question, are we going to include how much, if any, of the work on dimensional analysis and dimensional algebras are we actually going to include in the standard? Are we actually going to include the rules about units conversion in the standard? Will we, in fact, make distinctions between interval measures and coordinates? So, for example, if you talk about a 10 Kelvin temperature difference between the inside and outside of a building, that's an interval measure. If you say that the temperature is 273 degrees Kelvin, well, 273 Kelvins, that would tell you that it's about freezing. And there's been some impetus, I think, to include currency in this discussion rather than only physical units. So I think some of the speakers will address some of these issues, and if not, we'll return to them during the discussion. Another issue on slide five that we need to address is how are we going to encode this ontology? I'm actually assuming that we're going to encode it in some form of logic, but we need to be able to talk about units conversion, I think, and that suggests we need some arithmetic capability in our encoding technology. If we're going to talk about dimensional algebras, we need to be able to encode the rules for that dimensional algebra. There are also issues of how we might address dimensionless ratios for concentration of contaminants. We can talk about that later. And there will be questions about what kind of logic is suitable for encoding this units of measure ontology. I believe Pat Hayes will speak to some of these questions. And then in the discussion period, if not before, we need to talk on slide 6. What are the goals of this effort going to be? That is, how ambitious are we going to be? Who is actually willing to actively participate in this? And then we need to think about an institutional framework, both for the development of the ontology, for its dissemination, and perhaps for an ongoing website. And do we want to use either one of the formal standards development organizations, NIST or BIPM, metrology standards organizations. ISO has been active in this area. W3C, OASIS, and there are a number of other folks here, such as HL7. These are all, I think, the individual speakers will address these things, and then we'll be discussing them in the discussion period at the end of the teleconference. So having at that, I want to remind people to stay muted and to hold their questions till the end of the discussion, of the end of the presentation, so we can get through all of them. And I think we will start then with Stan Huff. So, Stan?
While my slides are loading, I give a brief introduction. I'm Stan Huff. I'm with Intermountain Healthcare and the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. And my expertise and the expertise of those who are with me is in use of units of measure in electronic medical records and in representing healthcare information. I have with me Yan Harris and Ming-Ching or Mark Lin, who are PhD students in medical informatics that work with me. My slides are up. Next slide. We have used units of measure within a hospital information system for over 40 years, and then we've created, in conjunction with commercial vendor partners, we've created units of measure hierarchies that have served for in the medical domain also, and we've done that with 3M, and now we're currently working with GE Health Information Systems as well. And these are all things that we're happy and in fact glad to share with the group as we go forward. Next slide. We've also been very active in HL7. HL7 is a standards group that is creating standards for interoperable exchange of information between health information systems. And in that environment, units are obviously very important in reporting laboratory data as well as other physical measurements. And within HL7, they initially adopted an enhanced set of ISO units of measure. More recently, they adopted the UCM system, the units of measure that were developed by Gunther Shadow and Clem McDonald at Regan Streiff Institute in Indianapolis. It's a strategy, basically, where you have the base units and then the multipliers, and it's rules for making combinations then of both the multipliers as well as the base units to come up with a standard set. And there's a specified grammar for making the proper combinations, and that's the currently adopted standard within HL7, and again could be input into the activities that are going on here. Next slide. So this is just talking specifically about a set of work that was done by Sundak Ganesan, who created a file that is generally available from the Centers for Disease Control in the U.S. that organizes units of measure based on dimensions and includes common user-friendly designations for those units of measure. Again, this is work that we can contribute and would be happy to contribute to this effort. Next slide. This is just talking about the fact that we are using units of measure as an important part of matching names of clinical data between different institutions. And again, that's just one of the use cases that we're using as we try and share clinical information, clinical measurements between different healthcare institutions. The units of measure become very important in both understanding the data as well as when you're originally setting up your data dictionary to understand which test in one facility matches up to a test that's being done in another facility. Next slide. So these are questions that are, I think, correspond to the ones that were set up as part of this discussion of what our scope is. You know, I think it's important to talk about how are we going to use it and units of measure, associations between kinds of units and kind of property or dimensions and units of measure. And then to talk specifically about any other sorts of reasoning that we may want to support. It appears that in terms of scope, that this is based on the audience, I'm assuming that health sciences, we're doing a lot more than just health sciences. And if there are any boundaries, though, it would be important to know those, or if the scope is completely broad, then that would be great. Another question is basically about the inclusion of synonyms, where, you know, you could have a lowercase L or an uppercase L for leader, or you could have the word, or you could have just the abbreviation, and whether that within scope is, if you will, sort of more of the terminologic aspects or the lexical aspects of some of these things as opposed to the pure ontological aspects and how much we would include there. Next slide, which is questions two. A question that's come up in our discussions within HL7 is whether we're talking only about, if you will, pure units of measure, which are milligrams and kilograms, et cetera. But there are common misuses of things that are not proper units, but they're in common use, and whether, you know, that those common misuses are something that we may want to denigrate or mark as obsolete, but may need to be considered in bridging to existing or legacy systems using units of measure. And the kind of things that you see are things like milligrams per gram of hemoglobin, where hemoglobin is, you know, the name of one of the compounds which should have been appropriately specified in some other part of the data or the message. So that's, I think, again, whatever we do would be useful, but these are questions that we could consider how we might make it more useful by being able to bridge to systems that are using these sorts of things. Next slide. This is question three. Another question is whether you include imprecise or improper. So, again, improper is a little bit pejorative, but things which you commonly see in medicine where it's milligrams per packet or milligrams per pill or milligrams per spray of something that was dispensed from an oral aerosol dispenser, milligrams per drop out of an eyedropper, that sort of things, which again are not purely quantitative but are in common use and actually have value. There are other kinds of imprecise things like Todd and Bethesda where what you're really dealing with are ratios between absorption or other sorts of things, which, again, I think was noted in the introduction as something that we need to think about. So, again, I'm in favor of a broad scope, We can mark things as inappropriate or obsolete or as improper, but it's, I think it aids people who are trying to use these to know where what they're using commonly fits into a proper units of measure sort of ontology. Next slide. That's my brief introduction. I look forward to hearing the other presentations and then participating in the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Stan. And thank you for keeping us on schedule. Our second speaker will be David Price. He's going to talk to us about the OASIS product lifecycle committee requirements for unit ontology. And David, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead?
So I'm David Price. I'm going to talk about the product lifecycle support TC in the OASIS community. So go to slide two. The use case for PLCS is that it's a standard used by organizations like the UKMOD and its contractors to integrate data. The applications are things like ship maintenance, aircraft maintenance, but also get delivered the design data, so, but not the complete design data, but what's necessary to develop what they call the support solution. So the idea is to integrate data, so it's actually a data exchange capability that the product lifecycle support technical committee standardizes. However, it has three parts to that capability. One is an XML schema, which is actually generated from another model written in the ISO Express language, and then a whole series of specs telling them how to use various subsets of those schemas to for particular data exchange, for example, aviation maintenance or something like that, and for example, feedback about maintenance applied to an aircraft. And then there's an OWL ontology related to this. So the basic idea is that the schema that's used for the data exchange is quite general. It talks about maintenance or tasks, for example, but doesn't talk about kinds of tasks, even to the level of maintenance task being a kind of task. All that detailed semantic is added by reference to an OWL ontology. There isn't, in the PLCS use case for data exchange, there's no particular requirement to use reasoning yet on this. We're still in the early stages of how to make this all work together. The expectation is over time that you will be able to use the ontology, perhaps augmented with other bits and pieces as necessary to do reasoning, but that's not the use case that I'm talking about today. Next slide. The related data exchange. So in order to relate the data in a XML document based on XML schema to the OWL ontology, we actually have basically copied two concepts out of OWL into the data model itself, so that we just basically have something called classification assignment, which is more or less like RDF type if that had been reified, so that actually people assign effectivities and dates and times and other characteristics to the classification itself. And then we recently added another exSameAs capability, very similar to OWL sameAs, to say an instance in the exchange file is the same as a class and individual in the ontology. Over time, we also hope to switch or augment the XML schema-based data exchange with the use of OWL for the exchange itself. Our user community is a little bit conservative about such things, so we're gradually working in that direction, but right now it's basically XML schema data exchange. Next slide. It's the ISO standard upon which PLCS is based actually has a high-level units ontology in it, if you will. This is a UML diagram of that. But the basic idea is there are units, length, time, various kinds of units. There's context-dependent units, derived units, and then there are values of units, and there's all sorts of related things like that in the schema. Just to give you the idea that there's units and then there's the values associated with units. And then if you go to the next slide, you see how we assign what are called in this vocabulary properties. So a property is assigned to something like the particular view of a product or a system, something like that. And then the property definitions related to multiple representations are possible. So we want to be able to have a text representation of a property as well as a numeric value with a unit-based representation of the property. For example, if the property is defining a requirement, we'd like to be able to have a text representation of the requirement as well as a computer interpretable representation of the requirement, if you will, of the properties related to the requirement, like cost, mass, things like that. The numerical items and the physical quantities and units related to them are only one kind of representation. So the whole picture needs to fit into this, the ideas behind some of this to be useful. Next slide. As the overall need is that we need libraries of properties, quantities, if you will, and then the library of units. We're happy to start with the SI units as actually populating the library of units because we expect extensions by using organizations. For example, organizations have the concept of a person day, the number of sorties for an aircraft, determine when it needs to be maintained, things like that. For us, the most important bit now is to set up a good structure that's extensible, including all of the possible quantities that are out there. And, you know, given the email discussions over the last few weeks, it's a lifelong project. So it'd be nice if we could just do something basic, but flexible, so extensible. We also need to have cross-industry consensus. We've got the PLCS world. Also working in a sister standard called Systems Engineering AP233. We also in this same ISO community have an oil and gas standard, which is a 4D ontology kind of thing. It's not written using OWL or RDF or any logic-based language, but it does have the similar concepts in it. The ontologies in the OASIS technical committee, and the DEXs are the name of those data exchange specifications. And then linked into the OMG, I'm glad Roger Burkhart is on the call. We're relating the Object Management Group's System L language with AP233, the ISO standard for System L, formally defining the mapping between the two, and the Systems Engineering ISO standard will use the same units ontology as the PLCS standard I'm describing, I'm representing with this slide. So there's it'd be very, very, very good if we could link in this activity with what's going on in OMG, with what's going on in the PLCS community, and link up the systems engineers and the support engineers. Next slide. So short term is actually the PLCS, we have sort of a ballot issue. OASIS, the version 1 of the standard passed its ballot. We're resolving ballot comments right now against existing OWL ontologies based on the data exchange schema. We had several problems related to units. In the ontology. In fact, this same ask capability was recently added with Gina to address some of those issues with that related to units. So basically, if you look back at that diagram, we want to replace the subclasses of units and the things related to it that are in that schema with the units ontology we're talking about on the call today. The instance of unit and exchange file will be the same as some individual of some type in the ontology. And we in the OASIS PLCSTC are not UNIX experts, so we're depending on ontology and UNIX experts to help us get this right. We don't, we'd rather use something someone else did than do it ourselves. The next slide basically just shows that what we'd like to do is take that diagram I showed earlier and insert this ontology we're talking about on the call, right, as if it was a kind of the unit specified in our data exchange file. And that's the end of my discussion.
Thank you very much. Our next speaker here will be David McComb, who's going to talk about the GIST unit of measure ontology. David, are you there?
I'm here.
Why don't you go ahead?
Great. Well, while my slide's coming up, just got back from late last night from an exciting but tiring week at the Semantic Technology Conference, and unfortunately, I picked up a nasty cold, so if I go silent for a minute, it's because I'm coughing or clearing my throat or something. But anyway, and also apologies, I didn't follow Peter's advice about putting numbers on my slides, so I'll just have to describe them. But if we could have the second slide, it's just called GIST. Up to about a week ago, the GIST unit of measure was just part of our higher-level GIST ontology, but Frank Chum from Chevron suggested that we could pretty easily peel it out, which we did. We've got now a separate standalone GIST unit of measure ontology. And what our objective there was, and the same as it is with GIST, is what's the fewest number of concepts we could have that would give us maximum coverage, minimum ambiguity, and precision. So, you know, that's what we're shooting for here. It's an owl ontology. So if we flip to the next slide, it's called We Partitioned Out. When we took out the unit of measure concepts from GIST, this is what we got. It's an owl ontology. We've got four object properties, four data type properties. There's really two fundamental classes that you have to understand and agree on, a handful of instances, and pretty much everything else is derivable, using usual owl axioms. So we can go to the next slide. We've got our four data type properties. No real surprises here. We have, most measurements are going to be in decimal values. We added in, somebody was suggesting earlier about currency. We have a separate currency value just to, almost as a clue, because almost all accountants do their rounding differently than most scientists do. So we kind of acknowledge that there. And then two data type properties that have to do with conversions between units of measure. One of our key concepts is that you can introduce as many new units of measure as you'd like, but you're obligated to say, how does your new unit of measure convert to a base unit of measure? And then in the case of units that don't have a true zero, like most temperature units, you also have to offset them to get to the equivalent place. Then we go on to the next slide. So what we, in earlier versions of GIST, we just had, sort of a frame style description of what units of measure were. But we pretty quickly discovered that if people start sharing information and they haven't, they may have agreed on the concept of having a base unit, but if they didn't agree on the same base unit, it just wasn't going to work. So we flipped it around, and all the classes are now defined in terms of these units. There's just a handful of individuals, owl individuals, units that, you pretty much have to agree on, and we'll build the classes out of them. Most of them are just the SI standard units. Well, I'll talk about in a minute why we added in cubic meters and square meters, two that we just really needed for business were dollars and eaches. So we can then go on to the next slide. There's really two main classes then that you just have to kind of accept, and the rest of them come from this. There's really three. I suppose I should have put a third one up here, but the first is the idea that there is such a thing as a unit of measure, and if you buy that, which everyone on this call probably does, you'd say that the unit of measure, you can introduce a new unit of measure as long as it has a base unit, and you can convert from this unit of measure to the base. So, I can invent a furlong, and as long as I say what the conversion ratio is from a furlong to a meter, then I've got a new unit. And then there's the concept, the sort of general concept of magnitude. And we say that, rather than allowing data type properties that have magnitudes, we say magnitude is a class, and you're obligated, all magnitudes have to have a unit of measure and a value, obviously. The third one that I probably should have put on the slide, we'll talk about toward the end, is the idea of a ratio unit. A unit that's made up with a numerator and a denominator, like speed or acceleration. Go on to the next slide. This is just a snapshot out of, I think this is Protégé or Top Braid. No, this is Protégé. So given those instances, we can derive all of our basic unit of measures here. So, for instance, the one highlighted, a distance unit is one where the base unit is meter. So any other unit that we introduce, if it has a base unit of meter, it will be inferred to be a distance unit. And then if we go on to the next slide, which has the same title, it just says the rest are derived, but it highlights the different class. Then we have a types of magnitude, in this case an extent. The definition there is it's a magnitude where the unit of measure is the distance unit. That, again, is derived from the previous. So if we go on the last slide, I just thought I'd put out a couple of other topics and mention a little bit where all the rest of the units went. We had, obviously there are some compound units out there in the world, and they, if you really factor them out, they come in two flavors. Ratios, which are, anything where there's two units of measure, one's divided by the other, so, obviously speed is a distance divided by a time, and acceleration is a speed divided by a time. But each of those, with some of the rules I think were suggested earlier, can easily be derived. So, if we wanted furlongs per fortnight, we just have to convert furlongs to meters and fortnights to seconds and convert them back and all that stuff. We could have done, and so that's a very generalized thing, and you can make up or include a library of any number of ratio units. We could have done pretty much the same thing with the product style, where you multiply two things together, but in general use, there's really only two product units, which are area and volume. However, we leave it open. You could extend it for things like newtons or anything else that requires two units of measure that are multiplied by each other. Then the conversion is just, we put in the conversion factors. We're not doing conversions in GIST. It's just a method of communication there. And then I guess I didn't mention, the only other thing that's different about currency than all the rest of these is you have to add a temporal dimension if you want to convert from one currency to another, because obviously the exchange rates vary over time, and we didn't put that in the base. That's an extension kind of a thing. And then the other is, again, not in the base, is measure and measurement. Measure is the idea that we're measuring something, and that it could have types everywhere from being actually measured to being estimated, predicted, or even a reference value. So at some point you have to indicate what kind of a magnitude do you have, and then measurement, which is not in the base unit of measures, is in GIST, includes who's the agent, what person or machine made the measurement, what process was used, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that the end of my slide, there's a reference to where the GIST unit of measure is on my Ontolog page, and take it from there. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much. Is Bob Dragoset on the call? Well, I don't hear him, and I don't see him, so I guess that means we'll go on to Rob Raskin. And hopefully Dragoset will alert us if he actually comes on. Rob, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Why don't you go ahead and talk about the SWEET scientific units ontology?
Okay, thank you. This was a tool developed at NASA for NASA to help searches for NASA data. Next slide, please. The SWEET project has been going on for about 6 or 7 years now. It's now an integrated set of almost 100 separate ontologies, and it serves all aspects of Earth system science and data associated with Earth system science. Earth system science is actually quite a broad discipline, many sub-disciplines, and that's part of the challenge of serving this diverse community. There's roughly 4,000 concepts altogether, and we're using OWL-DL. Next slide. So this is a breakdown, not of number of concepts, but number of ontologies. This kind of gives you a flavor of the kinds of communities that are served, from astronomy, atmospheric science, biology, all the way through some generic science space and time. The unit's ontology sits within within the science, the collection of science ontologies. Next slide, please. And this is essentially the same thing, but this is now showing some of these ontologies in the relation to one another. We've noted that some concepts are inherently abstract. Like in the very center of the circle, mathematics and measurement concepts tend to be the sort of the root of everything that we deal with in science. So that's kind of in the center. And you can recognize, you can see units just northeast of the center, just outside that center circle is units just above science ontology. So that's roughly where it sits. The purpose of this diagram is to show who imports who. An ontology in a more outer circle can import something more inner, but not vice versa. So a math ontology would not be importing a science or land surface ontology, whereas a chemistry ontology would, in fact, import anything inside of it, such as math. So essentially, the sciences will all be using, all be working with units. But units does use the math. That's important because that's where we have some of these concepts of arithmetic operations and interval quantities, conversions. They're actually all defined in the math ontology. And then we have a separate time and space ontologies, which also are based on the math, and those import the math concepts. Next slide, please. So the previous diagram was looking at the ontologies by discipline. Now, we also can look at the 4,000 or so concepts broken down by function. This was actually initially how we had. Initially, these were separate ontologies. The very first version of SWEET was divided up this way, but it wasn't very easy to, it wasn't maintainable. It was not scalable because as more domain disciplines wanted to add more processes and more phenomena, it was just those ontologies were growing rather large, and it wasn't easy for them to, by themselves, make those additions. And the current breakout of the ontologies, someone in a particular discipline can add some units. If they have a domain-specific unit that's just not used by other domains, they can define it. They can define it there. So the on this current slide, this is showing if we looked at this all the SWEET classes by function, units is used essentially on properties. Property would be something like temperature, pressure, height, so forth. Something that's measurable, and then we would say that measurable quantity has units. So it would be applied as a property in that property ontology. Next slide, please. Okay, so psi units. So we define both concept so now I'm using the word property in the OWL sense. In the OWL sense, has unit and has default units are both defined. Has default units would be the sort of like the recommended SI unit associated with a property, something like a temperature or a pressure. So temperature might be defined as has default unit Kelvin. But any particular application could override that with use of has unit, and then if they wanted to use, say, centigrade or Fahrenheit, they could just, a particular application, a particular data set, could just say that its has unit is not the default unit, it's something else. And this is sort of a community convention that we would just ask reasoners to look for the has unit if they're looking for a unit, and if they don't see it, then they can just go to the has default unit. So that's sort of a standard convention that we have for the community. This enables someone to override a unit that would otherwise be in OWL. You can't override it. Okay, so some other OWL properties associated with units. We have derived from units. We have which lets you make modifications like the prefixes, and then we use some of the math concepts, has power, product of. These let you do additional mathematical variations and combine different ontology elements, combine different other units to make new units, to make derived units. Next slide. So within SciUnits, the classes, we have base units, simple units, derived units, complex units, and then units derived by various means, scaling, shifting, raising to power. And these are all essentially the scaling, shifting, raising to power. Those are essentially defined in terms of these at the class level in terms of the mathematics, what the mathematics define what these do. Next slide, please. So all our units are represented in the SciUnits as individuals. This is actually not typical for SWEET, because most concepts in SWEET are classes, but the units themselves are actually individuals. And we initially populated the units ontology from a package that is used at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. That's the UD units. That's quite widely used. It includes all the SI units prefixes. Includes a little bit of the derived units for special community use. But where those did exist, we essentially migrated those to the application areas that were using those domain-specific ontologies. Next slide. So units are defined by combinations, like product of, has power, and again, we're keeping in the modularity theme of SWEET and keeping the domain-specific units out. Next slide, please. So an example, for units of power, we could define watt as a product of joule and per second, or per second would also have to be defined separately. And this is how we combine individuals to make new units. And then in some electricity and magnetism ontology, where we actually define the word power, we would say that has default unit of the watt. And this is the way that we connect the physical concept of power to actually assign it as the default unit of associated with power. So that's my last slide. This ontology set is sort of transitioning to, it's going to be taken over and being maintained by sort of a quasi-organization, the ESIP Federation. That's the Earth Science Information Partner Federation. That's a consortium of about 100 data providers. And they'll be responsible for long-term maintenance, and they're taking care of some other related aspects of data, registering data sets to this ontology, including the units. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's have Pat Cassidy talk about aligning the NASA SWEET SciUnits ontology with COSMO. Pat, are you there?
Yeah, here. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Why don't you go ahead?
Good.
After you're
okay.
Done.
Okay. Now, I haven't paid much attention to the individual unit ontologies and standards that people have been developing, because there are people who do that very well, and I don't need to get involved in that. I'm just waiting to see if they agree. So far, they haven't. So let us get on to the process of seeing if we can develop some agreement. Since we're here in the ontolog forum, I guess we're talking about developing an ontology that includes units of measure. And looking at the NASA SWEET units of measure, it looks very straightforward, a very nice and simplistic ontology. And I figured that would be a good place to start. So what do we do with an ontology of units? Well, if you want it to work with the big world and a lot of different applications that have to be aligned with other ontologies, And I believe that the only real way that one can do that is to have a common base ontology that integrates everything else. So I have been developing an ontology right now. It's very simple. It's an OWL version. It really needs to become first-order logic version. And the purpose of that is to provide a base with which you can translate among any other ontology. So having that base ontology, which I call the Cosmo, having the NASA suite units ontology, is there any way to integrate them? Okay, first we look at the suite units ontology. The way they present it, it imports the, we're starting up slide two. Okay, on slide two. The NASA suite units imports the OWL ontology. If you look at it in Protégé and look at the statistics, you see there are 47 classes, 27 properties, so on. And then if you go to the next slide, and let us say that actually all it really uses from the units ontology are two relationships. So to make life simpler, to work with this ontology, we just eliminate the import to math and recreate those two relationships. They can be linked again later at some point, but for the time being, just to focus on the units. We just go to the units, eliminating the math. What you have is you have 10 classes, 5 object properties, 6 data type properties. You still have the 91 instances of units that are defined. If we look at the Protégé visualization, that's the next slide. Now you can see the Protégé screen. You see on the left-hand panel the hierarchy is very straightforward. There are 10 units in the role, and there you have only two top units, prefix, actually top classes, prefix and unit. Then under the units have the different types of units that Rob was talking about. And then in the right, in the middle panel, you see individuals. What you're doing is you're seeing the individual base units that were defined, the ampere, candela, dimensionless unit, et cetera. So now we have this, and how do we link that to a general ontology that tries to represent everything you maybe would want to talk about? Well, there are only two top classes, a prefix and a unit. Unit is a measure, and a lot of ontologies have measures in them. That's one point of link. The other point of link is prefix. Now, I want to talk about prefixes because this should be really quite simple. And although it is very simple, you still have to come to agreement on how to handle certain things. One of the things, you can go back to the previous slide with the Protégé implementation. If you look here under the base units, they include the kilogram. And they have base units and prefixes. Now, if you take UCUM, you discover that the base unit in the UCUM is not the kilogram, but the gram. In the UCUM, they distinguish the real base units without prefixes from any unit that has a prefix. So here you have a terminology dispute. Okay, what you have here, what is called base units, in the NASA ontology is really system international units. And if you want to talk about base units that don't have prefixes, maybe you can go to the UCUM terminal. But this is terminology. There's no reason why you can't represent both of those in ontology, and then you have relations between them. All right, let's go back, into slide five. And this is why I want to talk about prefixes. Immediately you get into issues like this when you try to get a general representation. What's your base unit? Is it going to be the gram? Is it going to be the kilogram? Are you going to have a really nice, straightforward representation where you have a base unit plus a prefix, or with or without a prefix? Or now are you going to get and call your kilogram the base unit? And then you get into the question of what's the prefix of a kilogram? Well, there is none, of course. So that has to be resolved, and that's a choice. And my preference is everybody should have everything they want and just have relationships between them. So anybody can use any local terminology they want and then debate them. That said, you still have to ask the question of, within prefixes, what are the relationships between what you call a prefix and the strings that are used. Now, in the NASA, in a lot of ontologies and databases in NASA, they represent something as a string, and that's the end of it. But it turns out that strings tend to have meanings, and so just representing things as a string tends not to be the end of it. In the cosmo-ontology words, abstract strings and words actually each have a semantics of their own. They're not just strings, datatype strings, which have no further decomposition. So in Cosmo, you actually have a concept called prefix, which is a string of characters, but it can have a meaning. Okay, and the generic prefix with things like pre or on or in or re or these things, which actually have genuine meanings in a language. But that's no problem. The unit of measure prefix can just be a subtype of that kind of abstract prefix. Okay, having said that, you still have a ontological class, which is not a data type. Now you have to ask the question, what's the relationship between a prefix and these strings? Well, if you use the ontological representation, there can be two kinds of, or I prefer to have two kinds of representation, one which is directly to the data type string, and another is to an owl ontology string, which can be manipulated. Now, a data type string, if you want to manipulate it, you wind up writing procedural code, and you don't have logical relationships among them. The ontological concept of string, which I use in Cosmo, you can have concatenation, you can break it down into individual characters and so on. You can do all kinds of data of string manipulation that you would, say, with a Java program, but you can do it in a logical format. And so I think you're going to need both. You're going to need both kinds of representations, and this is a point of interaction, which should be, it sounds like it should be really, really simple. And it is fairly simple compared to everything else you do in ontology. It's really simple, but you have to agree on just how to do it and what the representations would be. Okay, now I go to slide 6, and I'll just want one last point. Why do we want to represent prefixes as something other than simple, just base strings? Well, because they have a meaning. You know, milli is a prefix, okay? But it has a meaning. And in fact, in some ontologies like Sumo, things like milli are represented as functions. You can have left parenthesis milli, and then some unit of measure, right parenthesis, and this now is a function which brings a unit of measure, which is 1/1000th of the original unit of measure. So this has real meaning, and in an ontology that actually can do some reasonable reasoning, probably want to represent it in a way where it has meaning. And then at the bottom of this slide 6, I just show where UMOM prefix falls into the general categories in the Cosmo ontology. You have a high-level thing called a tuple, which is a list, and a string is a list of characters, and the prefix is a type of string, and the UOM prefix is a type of prefix. And then slide 7. As for the other point of interaction, you have the point of interaction, which is prefix, to your main ontology. Second point of interaction is what is a unit of measure itself, and I'll show you here in Cosmo ontology, we have a thing called an attribute value. And among the attribute values, a subtype of attribute value is quantitative. Subtype of that is measurable. Subtype of that is physical. That's, say, things you measure on objects in the real world. And then under that, you have a unit of measure, which is a subtype of a physical quantity. And this is where that fits in with the Cosmo ontology. Then slide 8, there's also the question of abbreviations. In the NASA Suite ontology, they just have has symbol, which actually is what they use to mean abbreviation. But in an ontology in which a prefix or a unit of measure is actually full clone, first class type of entity, the symbol actually of kilo would be kilo, K-I-L-O, and the K would be an abbreviation. So then you have to distinguish between the symbol for the string symbol for the unit itself, and which is used in language, which may be different in different languages. And then you use the abbreviation, which may or may not be the same among scientists worldwide. Okay, and so recommendation is we need not just have symbol, we need to have a symbol and abbreviation. And again, what you want to call these is completely arbitrary, but the terminology is not important. The important thing is you have to have really two different kinds of pointers, one to the full prefix and the other to the abbreviation. Okay, and then slide 9. You notice that in language we understand what it means when you prefix a in my prefix, scaling prefix to a unit, and that has to be accounted for, I think, in your ontology if you really want the ontology to be able to handle things with some understanding and some interpretation that will allow it to do things automatically. So, as I say, in Sumo, they do that with a function. You can have milli as a function on a unit, or kilo as a function on a unit, which then generates a unit which is 1,000 times larger. That has to be agreed upon, too. How do you handle concatenation? Finally, I would say is the units of measure, among all the things we deal with in ontologies, it has very few links to higher level concepts. It's really, 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 really simple, and yet it presents issues that really still have to be agreed upon. I think the only way, because there are so many arbitrary ways which these units can be represented, I think probably the only way we're really going to be able to come to an agreement on how to represent it is to do the generation of a units of measure ontology within the context of some real application that's actually using units of measure ontology. And those people who have or are actually using it in some application, again, the application has to be basically public domain so that everybody can see it and see, use it, test it out. Not only see what it can do, you know, when you write a paper, you tell people this is what my system can do. What you don't know is what your system can't do. And the only way you can find what your system can't do is to have it available to the public so they can test it and see how it works with things they want to do. And then you find out not only what it can do, but what it can't do as well. You need public domain, open source applications, I think, to form the grounding on which we can come to any kind of agreement. Without that, I can foresee enormous amounts of interminable debate. Okay, that's all I have to say. I'll finish.
Thank you, Pat. Still no sign of Bob. Okay. In that case, we will go on to Howard Mason. Howard, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much. While you're bringing the slides up, just a brief introduction. I work for BAE Systems, which is one of the largest global aerospace and defense companies. I'm in the corporate IT office with responsibility for information standards, so very much a consumer of any potential ontology. In the standards world, I chair ISO TC184-SC4, which looks after industrial data, including the PLCS standard. And I also chair a group which coordinates e-business standards across ISO, IEC, ITU, the UN, and a whole bunch of consortia. So the challenge of integrating various standards to get a harmonized approach is not new. So if we could flip on to slide two, I'm really going to look at some of the fundamentals of standardization and some of the issues that we need to look at in the development of a harmonized approach. A standard's only an agreement in a particular community of interest. So how many communities of interest do we have here that need different sets of units? We're trying to achieve mutual benefit, and we're trying to make the best use of available technology. Ontologies are coming out as a technology solution. We ought to be able to use them. We also need to make sure that we fit in the market, because standards are only implemented voluntarily unless they're made mandatory. Okay, moving on to the next slide. If you're setting a standard, there are a number of key principles. You need to take into account a wide range of people who are interested in the standards, people who are using it for manufacturing, people developing systems, people who are using the results and their associated consumer groups. How do you test compliance? There's governments, there's engineering, there's research, there's academia. What do you need to be able to roll in those communities? We need to look, certainly in our industry, at global solutions, because we operate globally in a manufacturing world. We also need to ensure that we can encourage the voluntary participants to come in and make the necessary effort to set the standards. So, if we move on to slide four, why do we need multiple standards in the area? I think these are questions we should ask with the view of finding out whether there is actually a need for multiple ontologies in this area. Very interested to see NASA's federated approach. Do we need a federated set of ontologies for units? Don't know. The reasons that normally drive multiple standards is that you have different scopes of interest. And I'm not sure from what I've heard so far whether there's any need to have more than one ontology, more than one set of definitions. I've heard that UKIM took over from using the ISO units. It'll be perhaps interesting to explore why that was so. Have we got different groups of stakeholders that need different sets of contents? Can that be done by you simply subsetting the total picture, much as Dr. Price highlighted for the PLCS activity? PLCS data model is very large, but we meet specific business needs by using subsets. If we have genuine different communities of interest, to what extent do they need different sets of units? And we've all seen standards out there for units already in text form. Earlier speakers highlighted how do we want to be able to generate representations of those ontologies. XML, some other ontology language like OWL. Are there other applications that we need with a common underlying structure? And my final slide is a bit of a challenge as to why we might need other standards, other variations of standards. There are regional variations. You'll see in the supporting material the input from China. Is there a need to support different terminology around the world? We mentioned synonyms. How about multilingualism? Have we genuinely got conflict in the area of units of measure? Are there any outstanding issues that we might need to address? I would have said no, but there seem to be a couple of items creeping out of the woodwork that we need to address. Sadly, one of the reasons for multiple standardization activities is that people don't read what's there. And that tends to get established into development projects, which are very difficult to stop. When we started developing the STEP standard for product data, there were three competing international efforts, all with their own communities of interest. It's a major challenge to bring that into an integrated approach. And the last barrier we have, and this may well play into our discussions on where this standardization should take place, is to ensure that the results are openly available for use. And the challenge there is to ensure that they're publicly available free of charge on the web. And sadly, many international standards are, at the request of national standards bodies, not so available. They're publicly available, but you have to pay for them. Many of the web technologies are genuinely publicly available free of charge, and that might well condition how we think we go ahead on this. Now, just to finalise this, I have been, as part of the organisation committee, trying to involve the international standards community in this, and have actually made it as far as the president of the organisation that's responsible for units, but he was unfortunately unavailable. So you'll find further down the page some input from Jeff Williams, who's one of the responsible people in the British Standards Institute in this area, which gives some background to some of the international standards work in the area and how the pieces fit together. There are also a couple of useful hyperlinks in there. And with that, I think I've passed back to to Frank to move on to the next speaker. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Howard. Do we have Bob Dragoset on the call?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I think so. Is that you, Bob?
Yes, it is. I apologize. I thought the meeting was starting at 1:30. Got back in plenty of time, my time. And,
okay, not a tragedy.
I apologize for that. Basically, I have one comment to make, and that this is a PowerPoint presentation, and I had used it previously and made modifications for this presentation. There's more material in here that I'm going to cover today. Some of it's like background material, which I just wanted to leave in for references and such like that. I will not be covering it. I'll be skipping through it. But being a PowerPoint presentation, I have actually used some of PowerPoint's techniques of animation and scrolling text box. Those items, I will just use the word click if I'm clicking to the next aspect of it. But those of you using a PDF will not be able to see this animation. And so there's some references at the end which will help you as far as that goes. I don't think it will detract from the presentation very much. So let me go ahead and get started. Go to slide 2. And just a brief outline. Since I only have 10 minutes, I'm just going to skip over some of this stuff. Vision is that the UnitsML schema, I'm going to be talking primarily about UnitsML today, mention Units database, which we're developing at NIST. The UnitsML schema is actually being developed through an OASIS technical committee. But at NIST, we're working on Units database and also guidelines and tools for using Units ML and Units DB. Slide number 4, introduction. Really, the only thing I want to mention here is the second bullet, and that this was originally motivated by work done by Frank Olkin and John McCarthy quite a few years ago at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. And then there's some other collaborators at NIST. Slide 5. We had created a NIST UnitsML committee that's really working with the database and such, and mentioned some funding. Slide 6. The OASIS TC was formed July 12, 2006. We had deliverables that were due a year later, and we have not met those deliverables. One of the main issues that we've had problems with is that a lot of people in this area that we've tried to get interested in it, they're like, oh, yes, units are very important, but that's not my main job function, therefore I can't get involved in this. So the non-NIST participants in the fourth bullet on this slide 6 include a number of different entities, but right now, institutions, but right now the only ones that are active are University of North Florida and IEM, the two participants from there. The IEM person just joined and is not voting yet. And there's an OASIS requirement that in order to put forth a recommendation from a committee, you have to have at least 3 institutions represented. We've had people come and go, and we've just not had the sufficient number of participants in order to put out a version 1.0 of the schema, although it's pretty much ready to go at any point now. Slide number 7, background information. I'm going to skip all of this because I presume that majority of you are very familiar with units and quantities. So I'm going to skip ahead to go to slide 11. Just to let you know, on slide 11, just to mention that there are non-SI units that are actually considered in 3 categories, some of them acceptable, some of them temporarily acceptable for use, and unacceptable. Slide 12, starting about units markup language. Slide 13. So what I'm going to do is I'm basically just going to give you an overview of the design of UnitsML. And again, there's resources at the end if you want to go into this in more detail. I'm not going to cover everything here. I'm just going to try and highlight some items that would be important, I think, to an ontology group. So the first one is the top level. I want to make one comment. The schema was designed so that all the elements are global, so you can actually incorporate different parts of the schema without incorporating the entire schema. If you just wanted to do unit set, for example, you could do that. Slide number 14, and then click, brings up the image of the unit, and there are basically 2 attributes that are of importance, and that's that every unit or quantity, whatever, has a unique XML ID, and we have an attribute which points to a dimension for that specific unit. And then under the elements, if you click, the image moves up, and I'm going to be just talking about root units and conversions today. I'm not going to talk about the code list value. Click, going to slide 15. The root units This is essentially a way of expressing a complex derived unit in terms of root units. And under enumerated root unit, we have a list of units that you can select from. And those are like meter, kilogram. I guess gram is actually the one that's used because we need to build it up with prefixes. And then, of course, you have a prefix and a numerator denominator. So if the exponent is a fraction, then you can express it that way. This enumerated list is quite extensive, and it comes out of our SP811, which is a guide to the use of the SI or the US, and that's a resource at the end of the document. We'll be pointing to that. If there's a unit, then this brings up the conversions element, and this is called float 64 conversion from, messy name. But basically, we have done a very general conversion, a linear expression for making conversions, including uncertainties and number of digits such associated with the various coefficients. So it's a simple equation. If you click again, the image moves up. And then we also have special conversion if it can't be handled by a linear expression, or possibly you could point to a WSDL conversion routine online somewhere. These don't have much depth to them at this point, those two elements. If you click again, if you want conversion to instead of conversion from, the equation is easily manipulated around. So this will handle temperature conversions that are linear with additions and such, a little more complex. Almost all of the conversions are like y equals ax, so they're actually very simple, but we've made a more general version. Moving on to slide 17, skip that one. Moving on to 18 and click once brings up the image for the quantity element. And again, there's a unique ID. And again, you can point to the dimensioning of a quantity from one of the attributes. And then if you click again, the quantity image will move up. And you'll see that there's actually you could have seen it before, there's a unit reference, so this can go back and reference a unit. I didn't point it out, but from the unit element, you can also reference a quantity to relate these together. Click again, and we'll go to slide 19 and click once. Brings up the dimension element, and this is one place where you could point to, which would provide the information on the dimensioning. Whenever we have these things, we have URLs, you can actually point to anything you want. We've provided within UnitsML the ability to point within UnitsML, but you could point somewhere else. But this essentially is dimensioning. And if you click, that image will move up. And I would like to make one comment of something that we were sort of loath to incorporate, but realized that it was practically needed. And this is a deviation from your standard 7 base dimensions in the SI, and that's the last item on the list, which is called item. And our reason for doing this is that even though it's discouraged within the SI or not allowed within the SI, there's certainly a common practice that a lot of people will put items as scientific units that aren't really scientific units of measure. In particular, you'll get people to say that a certain rate is so many electrons per second. And, this is really incorrect. It should be the electron rate is the quantity, and that the rate is, unit is per second. But we recognize that people are not going to do that. We've allowed for essentially counted items to be included in the dimensioning. At the top level, there's also an element called counted items, so you can specify what the item is you're counting. This actually allows also the introduction for currency being included in UnitsML schema. We did not want to consider that as a scientific unit of measure. It's really a counting item, and we really thought it was inappropriate, but we felt it necessary to include this at this point. Obviously, if you're trying to use dimensionality to check on an equation. This is something that may or may not work. You know, these counted items. Do not encourage the use of it. SI does not either. So clicking again, going to slide 20. Again, we have prefix information as well, unique ID, the prefix base and power and such. So all that information is there. If you need that for numerical reasons in particular, determining what power milli is, for example, then it's a factor of 1,000 or 1/1,000. Going to slide 21. This has several animated portions to it. This is an example of an instance document from within UnitsML, and I'm just going to touch on a couple of items in here. So if you click once, you'll see that, again, this is an example of a unique ID for this particular unit, and the name is millimeter per second squared. IDs can be anything that's unique. Click twice, and you'll bring up the blue circle. Those of you watching the PDF, the first discussion was on the red circles. The next one is the blue circle, and it just shows the symbol. And actually, we have various types that can be included with the unit. I have given an example here of type HTML. This is important for the schema because, as you can see, there are actually embedded brackets, tags in there for the superscript. And we allow any tags to be included at this level, which means validating the schema can be an issue at this point. Of course, you can also put in ASCII and just have an ASCII symbol. If you click again twice, you'll bring up the green circle, which is the enumerated root unit, and this gives an example of exactly how this would be done. So particularly, I want to make a comment that our unit's database, we would never expect to have millimeter per second squared in that database. We might include that at some point, but we would never include something like millimeter per microsecond squared. Essentially have an unlimited number of complex derived units that can be created that are all valid within the SI, and to try and populate a database with those is almost unrealizable. So this is how the root units would be used to essentially define this in terms of known units that would be in the database and prefixes and powers and such. If you click again twice, you bring up the purple or magenta circles, and this shows how from within the unit element you can reference a quantity, which would then have detailed information about the quantity. In this case, it's acceleration. And then if you click again twice, you'll bring up the final animation in this slide, and that's that the two attributes in the unit and quantity elements for the dimension URL can both point to a dimension code that explicitly says that this is length to the power 1 and time to the power minus 2. So ideally, the dimensioning is actually from within the quantity, but we realize that some people may not use the quantity portion of UnitsML, so we've allowed it to be linked also from the unit portion. So 22 is just the full schema. Skip that. The database. I'm not going to go into great detail about that. We're developing it and usage of it. The UnitsML schema can be referred. You can refer to the schema. This is slide 26, excuse me. There are three ways. You can refer to the schema, include the schema, or import the schema into another schema language. There are three languages right now being worked on at NIST. Two of them are actively being worked on at NIST that they're considering using UnitsML. And slide 27 is the final slide. It's resources. If you're using a PDF, then the first link is useful because you can get the entire schema to look at, also the documentation associated with it. And then if you want to know more information about SI units and non-SI units for the U.S., go to the other URL. So I thank you for your attention, and any comments are appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Our last speaker... Well, I believe it's Pat Hayes.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Am I loud enough? Right. First of all, let me apologize for the quality of my slides, which are really, I had to make at the very last minute in a hell of a hurry, and are really just notes. And I'll apologize again for not really having a great deal to say. And when I listened to the other talks, realizing that I had even less to say, because a lot of it's already been said. So I was really just going to pick on one theme and kind of hammer it a little. And it is a general theme, but I think it's particularly germane at this point in this general area, which is basically that it's a good sort of ontological practice, I'm going to suggest, to keep, to not conflate notions together for efficiency reasons, even though it is efficient. And the list I have here is distinguishing between a thing, an entity, a piece of stuff. Psych makes that distinction very clearly, and many other ontologies don't. A dimension for measuring the stuff, a quantity of the dimension, and a unit. Now, I realized between making the slides and this moment that almost all the extant ontologies make most of these distinctions, or at least are compatible with them. But one can see certain tendencies. For example, some of the ontologies you've heard about are have a notion that might be called dimension, but they kind of derive it from by basically things that have the same base unit have the same dimension. That's exactly the kind of reduction or overloading of a concept that I want to argue is probably or maybe a bad idea. So if you can say that 320 grams equals 11.288 ounces, then that equation, if you're thinking about this logically or ontologically, means that 320 grams must denote something. There must be quantities that, you know, a thing called 320 grams. Following that kind of analysis or thinking, that line of thinking, you know, leads one to make these distinctions at the top of the slide. And having dimensions lets you do a dimensional analysis. Of course, that's I was going to talk about that, but other people have already talked about that at greater depth. So I'll just pass that over as an obvious thing. I will say, however, this is actually a question, I guess, for the last speaker. Those very impressive equational manipulations, I wonder if that system can use them to perform conversions, or can it use them to reason about conversions, as one would be able to, presumably, in a full logical representation. You get into questions like, given that there has to be a dimension, if there's a unit, then what dimension is money? And other people have raised that. I saw it on the chat line. And the answer seems to be, well, whatever that dimension is, that money is a measure of, let's say currencies are measures of, it has to be time variant, and it probably is a time variant vector field, if anything. It's something far more complex than a simple linear scale. So, next slide. Why make all these distinctions? Why not be efficient and keep the number of concepts small? Because very often, I can see this point, it's inference is often easier. And certainly, ontologies and standards are simpler when things are conflated, when you define one of these in terms of the other rather than keeping them as separate notions. Or even eliminate some of them altogether. You simply conflate notions of objects and pieces of stuff or whatever. The problem is interoperability. And if there was ever a hope in the whole future history of the planet that there would be a single global standard for this stuff, then this wouldn't be relevant. But I just don't believe that's ever going to happen. There will always be multiple standards and multiple conventions that were developed separately for different communities. I think we have several different communities of interest represented in this very meeting, and one can almost feel the different pressures that they feel. The scientists want things to be clean. They really don't approve of these dirty, messy things like electrons per second. The first talk we heard, people out there in the medical informatics world dealing with healthcare, want to accommodate just about anything that anybody could ever want to say. So there isn't going to be a single universal standard, and therefore we have to face up to interoperability issues. And interoperability is made much more difficult when concepts are not separated out but are kind of linked together in ways that are idiosyncratic to that particular ontology or standard. And a recent example that I came up in discussion, email discussion, Syke, bless his heart, has a notion of chemical element in which, for example, sodium is a class of all the mineralogical sums of pure sodium. So if you have a lump of pure sodium, it's an instance of the element. There are other ontologies of chemistry which also list all the chemical elements, but they don't mean that by sodium. They mean something else. It's therefore extremely dangerous to link to these two notions together with Owl's Say-Mass. I noticed one of our earlier speakers spoke of using Say-Mass between units. David Price using Say-Mass between units, but I noticed they also said that they haven't got around to doing inferences yet. And I would caution that the careless use of Say-Mass will turn around and bite you when you start doing inferences, unless you're really sure that these concepts are the same concept. So it's much easier to make concept-to-concept links when the concepts are have, as it were, a minimal and well-defined or clear ontological burden. It's better to have more concepts, each with a sort of clear conceptual weight, rather than to try and minimize the number of concepts if one is concerned with interoperability. That was, I guess, the sort of general speech I wanted to make. Since I've got the floor here, I thought I might make a couple of comments on some of the things that were said earlier. I was very struck by Bob Raskin's presentation from Sweet, and the fact that everything's an individual, and also seeing things like unit derived by raising to power, which is very psychish, and the math ontology notions of has power and product of. I mean, what this seems to be doing is basically coding simple arithmetic equations into description logics. The fact that all units are individuals, again, that's description logic talk for these have to be first class entities. We need to be able to talk about them, put them in categories, have the relationships between them and other things, which you can't do to classes in a DL framework. And I think that's a symptom of something important about the kind of underlying logic that's needed here, is that to describe all this well is going to require a very expressive logic, an expressive notation, if you like, one that lets all these different categories of entity stand on their own and be first-class entities that can be related in complex ways. And this was actually this point was, I think, underlined or made spectacularly true by Pat Cassidy's talk and also other similar notions that were referred to by other speakers, in which notions like milli or kilo themselves have to be first class entities. They have properties. They have meaning. And if those meanings aren't put out into the ontology explicitly, then a great deal of ability to reason about and to link concepts together is lost. And that's quite a demand on a logic, in fact, that it's able to reason about its own name, the structure of its own names. Cosmo can do it. The IKL logic we invented a few years ago can do it to a limited extent, but very few logical systems can. So they would need to be extended by mechanisms for doing that. I guess I'll stop at that point.
Okay. Thank you. I think this concludes our speakers, unless I've overlooked somebody. So we're now going to launch into, well, some of you who have access to the webpage may want to note that we have two other folks here, Lin Zhang, who's been working on translating various units ontology stuff into Chinese, and Joffrey Williams. So some of you may want to take a look at their input. I don't believe they're on the teleconference, as far as I know. And now we have, I guess, 45 minutes for discussion. You may recall my slides from the beginning. There are a number of basic questions we have to address. One, let me just start with what the scope of this is going to be. So some of these ontologies, efforts of ontologies, have talk about units conversion. Some of them just talk about the units. And some of them also have dimensionality. So why don't we talk right now, first of all, about whether or not to make a distinction between units and dimensions. And secondly, let's then talk about the unit conversion issues. So who would like to speak? I don't see anyone raising their hand.
Okay, yeah. It's good time to...
Oh, James Davenport.
Yeah, raise your hands.
Okay, thank you. Yes, I think you need to distinguish dimensionality because there are two ways of measuring, for example, fuel efficiency for cars. In the UK, we tend to measure it in miles per gallon. On continental Europe, it's often in litres per 100 kilometres. These, of course, are reciprocal dimensions. Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else? Mark Linehan. Go ahead. Star 3 to unmute.
It took me a moment. So in my mind, units are the specific kinds of ways we measure things, such as seconds or kilograms and so forth. But in fact, there are many units of measure that are on the same dimension. For example, time is measured by seconds, hours, days, years, etc. And so what is important is that you can compare different units of measure and values that are using those units of measure if they're on the same dimension, and they're not comparable if they're on different units of measure, different dimensions. This is, in fact, the distinction that the Min standard uses. Thanks.
I didn't get the last sentence. The distinction that who uses?
There's a standard called VIM, which is the metrology standard. I'll put it on the chat note when I get the proper title for it.
Okay. I'm inclined to agree. Let's see. The other issue is, and maybe Pat can say a bit more. One question is, to what extent can we put the dimensional analysis, or variously, the units conversion stuff, into logic? And how expressive a logic are we going to need to be able to do that? Because most logics don't have any way of directly talking about arithmetic. Pat?
I presume you mean this Pat Hayes.
Pat Hayes, yes.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. I mean, it depends exactly what one wants to do with the arithmetic in the logic, right? I mean, the way that the suite, as I mentioned, the suite ontology handles arithmetic relationships like product and so forth, is a perfectly good description in, there's a lot even just in description, in description logic, sort of very weak logic actually, it describes arithmetic relationships. So you can encode, certainly, up to, you know, polynomial kind of relationships between things by writing them all out as relations. Now, that's, if you want to actually, you know, run a calculator over this stuff, that would be a very clunky way of encoding it, although you could write things that would adapt that. It's not clear whether that's going to be adequate. I think it probably, for practical purposes, it is going to be adequate, actually, for what we want to do. We don't really need to have, you know, first-order logic plus arithmetic, some sort of super logic.
because unless we want something that is both an ontology and a sort of practical calculator, but that's probably asking too much. Does that answer your question?
So you think we can get by with a garden variety logic and some sort of tool that will load this up and then turn it into doing real arithmetic, but not directly doing the arithmetic in the logic inference engine?
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think it would be perfectly fine to have a specialized inference engine that recognized the logical descriptors corresponding to arithmetic relationships, and when it could, just went off and downloaded the calculation. I mean, in other words, it would be specialized to that extent. But one doesn't need to encode all the arithmetic in the logic in a kind of traditional mathematical sense. One can just transcribe it almost into the logic, which is, I think, I haven't looked in detail at the suite math ontologies, but from the bits that we saw in the talk earlier, that looks like what they've done.
Can I ask a question here, this Pat Gaston?
Okay, Pat.
Yeah, to Pat Hayes. Are you envisioning a logic that includes functions, or do you think that this could be accomplished in something like OWL? My intuitive feeling is you really need functions to do any kind of arithmetic.
Well, you can always transcribe a function into OWL with enough. It's just hideous, but it can be done.
Yeah. I agree. You can represent it in OWL, but as you say, it's so hideous. It's very difficult to understand as a problem. Okay.
Right. But then again, people will argue, and I'm sympathetic to that. That's a matter of designing a good human, or, you know, a good human-oriented interface for your for your standard.
Okay. Going back to our queue, I think we've heard from James and Mark. Dave McComb.
Yeah, I guess as the guy who was conflating dimensions and units, I should speak up on that one. You know, several years ago, I did have dimensions separated out as a separate thing or facet, if you will. But when you end up defining your units based on what base they have, you know, such as a time unit is something that can be converted to seconds. I don't know. I'm happy to put it back in, but I don't find any use for a distinct dimension. So maybe it wants to speak to that. I heard Pat, but I didn't get an actual reason. There's kind of a description there, but is there a need for a dimension above and beyond the things that can convert to the same base unit, or, you know, de facto in the same dimension?
Pat Hayes, do you want to respond?
Yeah, let me just quickly respond to that. Yeah, I should have been. Actually, it was illustrated by some discussion on the chat line earlier, which is, if you reduce dimension to, as you did, it's very elegant, actually. I jotted down your construction. I think it's basically amounts to having a common unit type and two units are the same type if they're the same base unit. So two measurements of the same dimension, if they're both what we would call length, if they are expressed in units which have both are multiples or something of the common base unit, kilometers or whatever. Now, that's great as long as everybody is clear about the notions of base unit and they all agree what it is. But, you know, if someone comes along and says, oh, I love that idea of base unit, but my base unit is the meter or the centimeter, then everything's going to go wrong when you try and put those two together. If that one conceptual mismatch is going to propagate through everything and break just about every inference you can make. This is what I meant by interoperability. A way of putting it is it's fragile. It gives you an inherently fragile system for aligning concepts up between different ontologies. Whereas if the concepts are kind of there, so there's a notion of dimension and there's a notion of unit and there's a notion of amount or whatever, as separate concepts that you can link to independently, then you have a certain degree of robustness, because even if one of them is wrong, the mistakes, the inferential mistakes can be localized, typically. They don't sort of infect everything. You know, you can see, okay, yeah, but we got the wrong conversion factor there for that length or something. but it doesn't kind of, you don't actually finish up with a different notion of what a length is, which is, you see, that's also, I hope I got the point across.
Okay. Next person up, I believe, is Doug Mann.
Okay. Doug? I've got, can you hear me, Frank?
Yes.
Okay. I've got 2 points. One, I feel that the use of the dimension, or in ISO's terms, the quantity, is extremely important with, along with path, just to keep things straight. The other question I've got is, throughout this set of presentations, we've been using the term dimensionality and quantity, whereas one, I guess, some communities use dimensionality. ISO, in the ISO 31, uses quantity. And I think we've got to be very careful to have our, we say, correct terms that we're using, so that the others that are listening can understand what's actually being said. That's all.
Doug, do you want to reiterate? Are you suggesting that we've got two separate terms here, both of which are referring to the same thing, namely quantity and dimensionality?
Correct. Go to ISO 31, and in fact, in Bob's one, he used the term quantities, ISO, whereas many of the others were using dimensionality to mean that same thing, such as length.
Okay, point taken. I'm not sure I'm altogether clear that quantity is the same as dimensionality. But,
in SI, there's a quantity dimension, this is Joe Collins, which really, dimensionality is often used more colloquially, but within SI, quantity dimension is pretty much what most people are referring to.
Okay, thank you, Joe.
Opinion.
Let's see. Pat, your hand is still up.
Yeah. I just didn't weigh in on this. Yes, I really think that the dimension and the measure are truly two different things. That you have measures, and then a dimension is whatever that thing is a measure of. And the other problem is that people will be constantly inventing new dimensions. I mean, you want bits per second, for example, for information transfer. And these are not part of the SI units, and they're not reducible to that. So when they invent new measures, they'll be inventing new dimensions. The other thing, the third thing is, and I agree with Hayes on interoperability, only I have a sort of take on this, that...
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Work with the NASA Constellation Program, developing a units and quantities and dimensions ontology for the Nexium ontology. And I wanted to weigh in on this, the distinction between quantities and dimensions. And I believe that there is a, there's an important distinction there, which is a physical quantity like electric charge or length or mass. It has, in some sense, a definition that's independent of like a system or a standardization. Whereas with like SI, you identify base quantities and then use those to define the dimensionality of units or of derived quantities. So, I think it's important because if we're only talking about SI, then there is in some sense the dimensionality and the quantity are one-to-one. But if you want to talk about systems of quantities or systems of units besides SI, then you have a situation where a quantity like electric charge is a derived quantity in the SI system and has dimensions of time times current. But in like the Planck system, it's a base quantity. And so the dimensionality of electric charge you know, different depending on what system of units, system of quantities you're using. That's all.
If I understood your remark correctly, you're arguing that, in fact, quantities are something semantically more fundamental than dimensions. Is that
yes.
a fair characterization?
Yes. I would say that the dimensionality is only, the notion of dimensions is tied to a system. It's tied
okay.
to the choice of your base quantity.
I think our next speaker is Frank Chum. Frank? Sorry for you to unmute.
Yes, I, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Okay. So, I, looking with, at the set of presentation is really extensive and I really like that. And then I realized that when Howard entry from ISO by saying about different scope, is there opposition to one set of UOM definitions? And then I sort of think about, you know, having an upper ontology of UOM that is the mother of all ontologies, that is including everything. And that's one of the things that upper ontologies becomes very difficult to use because you have you try to incorporate everything into it. And so I see that there's the science ontology and then also the NASA's scientific unit ontology, and of course Dave's that is for business, and so I think if one separates them out into different scope, you can actually enhance the adoption rather than you know, building a mother of all ontology. So I just want to hear the, you know, the comments from the audience or if what would be a preferred way of doing this rather than, you know, if everyone agrees on having scope specific UOM or just single UOM ontology. So.
Okay, so maybe some people want to speak to
that.
I think the next person up is Howard Mason.
Thanks. Just to note, we had a discussion on quantities versus dimensionality. That all expels very well in the BIPM document, which is referenced in the contribution from Jeff Williams, and is freely downloadable on the web. And I would encourage you to scan through that because it gives a number of useful answers to some of the questions that seem to have been emerging in a way that is already internationally agreed. Picking up very much on Frank's view of having an upper ontology of SI units and that maybe other sub-ontologies related to that, that's fine provided that we can eliminate any the duplication and conflict and the challenge that I raised in my presentation of people inventing new units just because they're not in the same lower ontology. We need to be able to pull together a coherent big picture of this and use it wherever feasible. Okay?
Okay. I think our... let's see. In about 10 minutes, I think I want to switch our conversation to sort of organizational things. But we've got a couple of speakers left here. I think Pat Hayes is next. Is that correct?
Yeah, I just want to ask a question specifically of Stantoff. I'd love to hear more, if you could say something more, about the things he was talking about at the end of his presentation, these imprecise and improper units, like milligrams per packet and so much per drop and absorbance units and so forth, because it seems to me that those are the things that sort of stretch the conceptual space that we have to think about. CGI units and MKF units and all the physical stuff is kind of clear, but this stuff's intriguing and that may require ontologists to be stretch in new ways. So, question, could we have more info about that, please?
Dan, are you on there? Star 3 to unmute.
Hello, this is Mark, League of Stand Up.
Okay.
That's Dan, it's not here.
Okay, Mark, why don't you try to answer, or Jan.
Talk about the improper unit. Can you repeat that, the question that you say, is that the proper thing, or you want to include that, or you suggest that the ontology don't deal with that?
On the contrary, I would like it to, or I'd be interested in finding out more about what's needed to cover these cases, and Stan mentioned a few in passing, and I'd like to know if there are any more. He mentioned the notions of milligrams per drop and absorbance units and Todd-Bethesda ratios.
We will contribute some examples. Recently, we just do some mapping to the laboratory test between the two institutions. And usually we need to deal with 1,000, 2,000 kind of different laboratory codes. So from our point of view, if the union measure, they provide more information, like they also include the analyte name or compound name, that will bring more information to that. So for that kind of point of view, that we think that maybe the syntax is not improper, but for the information kind of perspective, that kind of thing provide more information, we suggest we should include that kind of phenomenon. But then maybe we can comment more on the improper unit with the hemoglobin.
I mean the perspective is that it's those things are sent to us from lab systems, and in the ideal world we would have the ability to control what was sent in those lab systems, but we don't. So we would like, you know, we would like to have a strategy where even if their use is deprecated or their mark is obsolete, that there's some way in the ontology to know that, milligrams per gram of creatinine is a deprecated form of where it really should be, you know, grams per grams or some actually unified ratio or something that you're really talking about. So that's sort of the use case.
Yeah, maybe if we also want
Thank you.
To add our experience about using the dimension that, because I mentioned when we do the matching, we usually face thousands to thousands of different kind of things. So based on our experience that if we know the union measure its dimension, so then we can segment those laboratory tests into a different dimension, then that will help us to reduce the search space. So from our point of view, that using the dimension provides lots of information and some practical use.
Okay, I think the next speaker is Gerald Raddock, and then after Gerald, I think we need to spend a little time talking organization and future planning here. Also, the whole block of people who have their hands up, whom I think have already spoken, I'm not sure how you take your hand down. Maybe if Peter's still on the call, he can tell people how to do that.
Yes, if you press the same hand button another time, one more time, it'll lower your hands. That it toggles. Actually, while I have, I'm on the call.
Gerald, do you want to say something?
Yeah, as I mentioned before about unusual units. There's a lot of units like that in logistics. Like, you can order things by the carload or truckload, have items per pack. So, you have to think beyond just scientific units.
Okay. Well, we will need to keep that in mind. We need to think some about organization now, mindful of Howard's remarks that we would like to try and converge on a single standard ontology, I think. But the question is, what sort of institutional framework do people think that we should be trying to develop this under? I mean, there are a variety of candidates ranging from W3C to NIST to ISO to HL7, OASIS. Why don't people, let's see, Mark and Doug and Stan still have their hands up. But why don't people address the question of which organizational framework do you think would be best for pursuing this work? Anyone?
I would vote the NIST. It's Pat Hampton.
Okay, so we have one vote for NIST, which I think, so the issue there, there are two issues. One is, that's attractive for the United States community, because they could provide a framework for pushing this out as a U.S. standard, hopefully. But I'm not sure how well that fits for everyone else. And they've been focused on the XML work rather than what a logic-based formalism for the ontology. Bob, looks like you've got your hand up there. Do you want to speak to that?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes, I'd just like to say that actually in the chat part, Evan Wallace mentioned, who's also from NIST. NIST is not a standards development organization. We work with standards bodies to help them develop standards. That's why, for example, UNISML, we went to OASIS in order to get the standard developed. We work closely with standards development organizations, but we're not one ourselves. So it would not be appropriate to have it entirely at NIST. It would be appropriate for NIST people to be closely involved in it. And actually, Evan Wallace, who did put the chat notice up, he's actually an ontology expert here at NIST, one of them. So, we would welcome the chance to work on that, but we would not take the job on solely at NIST.
I would like to speak to that point. Okay. I think in the initial phases, we shouldn't be thinking about developing a formal standard. That a formal standard should have some level of stability, and I doubt that this will have any level of stability until there are at least several applications, publicly available applications that can be seen that actually use it, that people can evaluate it and test it out. So I think NIST is appropriate, which is why I suggested it, at the early phases where you're actually starting to talk about developing a formal standard.
So was that Pat Cassidy?
Yeah, Pat Cassidy.
Okay. Let's see. James Davenport, did you want to speak to this?
Yes, James Davenport here. W3C, as I understand it, is not a standards maintenance organization as such, but I would certainly like to see as much use as could be made as MathML in the representation of these things within XML. Of course, the ontology need not be XML. It should have an XML representation these days, I would claim. Thank you.
Okay, so you think that if we're doing something akin to UnitsML, which is an XML encoding, that you would like to see the use of MathML as part of that to encode the mathematics?
That's right, yes.
Okay. Point taken. Howard?
Interesting one. I take very much the point that this is going to be a little bit of an effort before it's ready for standardization. What I would suggest in order to get the maximum degree of acceptance by the people who are already out there is that we negotiate with BIPM to highlight the fact that we see a market for this activity, invite them to participate in that and to sponsor the result, because if they can make it free of charge as part of the general units of measure environment, that will give it probably the broadest degree of credibility. It can then get picked up into any of the consortium activities as required. But for the long-term base, that's probably the right place to go. And then it can be referenced by the ISO work and by anybody else. What I would not like to see us do is setting up an alternative set of definitions which will undoubtedly cause more political debate than it's worth doing. But I think we've got the necessary components and expertise to make a success of this, but let's do it with the people who know what assumptions have been made on the various units. It also gives us the advantage of being able to feed back some of the other stuff that has been identified within that structure and basically get it harmonized. So we probably need a loose project collaboration capability and tie it into BIPM, my opinion. Thank you.
Okay. And do you know the name of the or names of the requisite people at BIPM for us to contact?
Well, actually, it's under the control of the CCU, and I've been exchanging emails with the president of that, Professor Ian Mills. His immediate reaction was basically to look up ontology on Google, become totally confused and say, you're going to have to explain this in a bit more detail before I can make any comment on it, because he felt that they couldn't make a contribution based on the philosophical definition of ontology that he found. I have endeavoured to correct that impression, and we'll continue to exchange emails, I'm sure, until with the results of this session. So we have the necessary contacts through ISO to be able to engage with them.
Howard.
Okay.
Howard.
I believe the next speaker up is Douglas Mann.
Okay. Frank, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I wanted to make sure I wasn't on mute. A couple of the points. At this point in time, I don't think it's ready for being a standard. I think it's, should we say, a journey down to get there. And being the need to have extensibility for other arenas and stuff, we may not end up with what could be a standard. We may have the structure for the semantics of what this should be. The other thing is that the representational paradigm that this is represented in probably should not be a standard in any one particular community, with different communities desiring different things, such as the different ontology representations or the various XML representation type labels. I think we've got to distinguish between the model and then the way we represent the model. And then going back to another question of getting things freely available through ISO, there is a way to do it, and within ISO, and in fact, there's probably close to 200 to 300 ISO standards that are freely available. And I think pressure could be put on ISO to make something like this freely available. That's all.
I concur with that. BIPM is free already, though.
Mark, you wanted to say something? Sorry, I was on mute.
Yeah, I have several points. First of all, whatever community you decide to do this in, it's important, or it is better if it's one of the established groups that have been mentioned, such as W3C or OMG or OASIS, from my point of view, because they have established policies about how they handle contributions of intellectual property. And I'm from a company that has to be worried about that. If you do it, it's a very informal thing, then I don't know how we would manage that. So I would very much like to see you adopt one of these existing standards communities, and I don't really care very much which. Let's comment one.
comment too is, I think it's really valuable to look at the existing ISO standards. They actually do establish a lot of things that you could and that you could transform directly into an ontology, such as in Vim, a lot of the definitions there are fairly clear and could be used. So I think you're really best off to start with what's already there in the existing standards, and I think working with BIFM would be a great idea. Thirdly, I think any standards group that you join, I would encourage following the practice that somebody previously mentioned, which is that there should be existing implementations of what you want to do before you actually try to make it into a standard. I have been working in a group OMG that does it the other way around, and I think it's a mistake based on my experience. And lastly, I would endorse the point that we shouldn't focus on a specific representation scheme, whether it be OWL or XML or anything else. I think we should be trying to come up with a general purpose ontology that we can then implement in various ontologies as desired. That's it. Thanks.
Okay. Let's see. I've got Mark Linden. Oh, Mark disappeared. Bob, you wanted to say something? And then we're going to probably have to start wrapping up.
Yes, I just wanted to make one comment about the BIPM. I know the two representatives, I think they're the representatives from the U.S. on the CCU, the BIPM, the Consultative Committee on Units, and neither of them I think would be appropriate for developing an ontology. They're both excellent people as far as units are concerned, but they have essentially no ontology knowledge, and so if it was taken on by something like the BIPM, I think we at NIST would send other people to represent us. So I just want to make that clear. I think that, as it was mentioned, that the person went online and found a definition of ontology and was totally confused. You might find a lot of people on that committee in the very same position. And so you might be looking for other people to be involved in that through the CCU and the BIPM than are standardly involved with that.
That's okay. Why
so
I specifically said work with rather than use.
Something of a sense that maybe we should organize this more like, I think in ISO they're called study groups or something like this. Doug, what's the term that ISO uses for studies before they embark on a standard?
So, they create study groups, but the problem comes up that the purpose of a standard is that it is a specification and not an implementation that much.
In general ISO terms, we use a preliminary work item. Study group is particularly a JTC1 construct, but effectively we can do the same thing. It's a method of getting the right people together to come up with a clear definition of what needs to be done.
Okay. So, I think we'll have to continue this discussion over email. I would think on the Ontolog forum. Peter, you want to, or does someone want to suggest another email list where we could have this discussion?
Peter here. There are two ways we can go about it. One is there's already agreement that we will create a separate list for the 8 or 9 projects identified at the Ontology Summit. If we take that one step further, and given that we have so much momentum here, I am perfectly happy to create just one units of measure ontology standard related mailing list just for this particular thread of discussion. And in fact, I did have requests for that, particularly from Conrad Bach of NIST. So this is totally doable.
Peter, you need to speak up.
Yes, I was saying I would be happy to create a list, a mailing list, just for this discussion thread for what we're trying to do here.
Okay, so for the next step, could you create that mailing list and put some sort of pointer to it on this panel discussion wiki page, and maybe send email to the people who are listed as attendees to this panel discussion?
Okay.
Is that doable?
That's totally doable, except that, I mean, there are several names I don't recognize. I would request everyone who is not already an Ontolog member to please send me an email if you're interested. That way, at least I have your email, and then I can continue to communicate with you. I don't think it would be a stretch if I say I will automatically add everyone who is here at this session to that new mailing list. But if you want to opt out, let me know too.
Okay. So let's start with that, and we can continue the discussion as to how to proceed. I think that to the extent there was a consensus here, what I'm hearing is, A, we do want to differentiate between, well, perhaps even three things, at least quantity, dimension, and units. And I think there was a sense that we need to view this at the moment as more of an exploratory effort than a formal standards effort, so that we could try to put something together and some people could try and use it before we push it through a formal standardization effort. I'm not sure, there seemed to be some dissent here as to whether we should pick one encoding or another. I think we actually need at least one encoding for people to be able to experiment with this, but we can continue that discussion on the mailing list. I think one of the particular questions is, for example, do we need functions in the logic system and things like this? But we're at almost at 2:30, and I'll put out let's see. I have a queue here with two people. Pat and Peter, did you have short things you wanted to say?
No, not for me. I already said that I should have.
Yeah, I just wanted to just put on the table the possibility that we shouldn't be going to one single standard or thinking about that initially. That maybe we should be looking for sort of points of agreement and consensus and see if they converge to one. And if they converge to two or three, maybe that's the best we can do.
Okay. well, let's continue this on the mailing list. Peter will create it and stick it, a reference to it on the conference call wiki page. And perhaps we can continue this starting next week. I'm also thinking that perhaps we want to have at least a birds of a feather session or maybe even a small workshop before or after ISWC in October here near D.C., somewhere in the metropolitan area. I think a fair number of people will be at that meeting, and it might be a place to do a sort of face-to-face meeting following up with this. I don't want to drop it between now and October, but I don't know that it'll be possible to organize much in the way of a face-to-face meeting before October, unless someone has another venue that they'd like to suggest. Okay, so I'm going to conclude the teleconference now, and we will continue this on the email list that Peter Yim is going to construct for us. Okay?
Okay, goodbye.